You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rhodes, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. Today, I'm joined by Katie G. Salisbury to discuss her new book, Not Your China Doll, The Wild and Shimmering Life of Anna May Wong. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so I'm very excited to talk to you about this book, because maybe it's just me, but it seems like Anna May Wong is really having a moment. Her name is everywhere. There's exhibits I keep hearing about, articles, and she's even on a quarter. And so it feels really exciting to see her becoming so mainstream, such a household name, like 60 years after her death. You know, I'm sure this is in part due to your work, but do you have any ideas about, or what do you think it is about this moment in time that's really resonating with her and her story?
That's a great question. You know, when I first learned about Anna May Wong 20 years ago, I was a college student. I had never heard of her, and I went around and asked people if they knew who Anna May Wong was, and basically everyone I spoke to had no idea. So it is such an amazing thing to watch her legacy and her memory be, you know, come back with such full force now that we're in 2025. And I think partly it has to do with the fact of what's going on in Hollywood right now, right? Ever since Crazy Rich Asians came out, we've seen kind of the floodgates open to Asian American actors, as well as Asian American storytellers, people who are also working behind the camera. And I think that huge change has also brought with it a lot of questions and like the desire to look back on history and think about, well, where do we come from? How do we get to this point? And if you go back in time, it really starts with people like Anna May Wong, who was making films in the silent era, right? At the very beginning of Hollywood filmmaking.
Yeah, she's really pioneering that. And you mentioned in your book that her drive, you know, she wasn't just interested in fame and fortune, but she was also very motivated by advocacy and was very aware of her position and what her success would mean for Chinese Americans. But it's also a lot of responsibility for a young woman, because when you succeed and you break ground, it's great. But when you fail, it's really public and it sounds lonely and stressful. And that did come to impact her physical and mental health. And so I'm wondering a little bit if you can talk, too, about how her career helped folks, but it also was really something that was challenging for her on a lot of levels. It came at a cost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she started in the films at age 14, right? That's when she starts doing her first extra work. So in the beginning years of her career, it was this thrilling thing, right, to be a part of a new artistic medium, to become famous, be making a lot of money. But gradually, over the course of her career, her understanding of what it means to be this public figure really evolves, right? Because she's also starting to see the limitations she's facing in Hollywood because of her race. Because she's Chinese American, they won't put her in leading lady roles opposite white male actors because they don't want to portray interracial relationships. You know, this is an era in which anti-miscegenation laws rule the land, so you can't have, you know, people marrying other people of different races. And, you know, throughout her career, she faces a lot of different challenges. She's a very resilient and creative person and very determined to be an actress, right, in any way she can. And so that allows her to go back and forth to Europe. She goes to China as well to kind of expand her career. But yes, as you allude to, there were a lot of personal costs, right, to having to deal with very public disappointments. For example, when she doesn't get cast in The Good Earth, that's a very public thing because the Chinese American community has rallied around this big film. It's meant to be a sympathetic portrait of the Chinese. But she, you know, is endlessly creative and basically creates a counter narrative by planning her first trip to China. And so in this way, she's kind of always yo-yoing back and forth between the no's she's getting in Hollywood, and then coming up with a creative solution that allows her to continue working. And in many ways, like breaking new ground. For example, in the late 1930s, when she comes back from China, she's able to make a series of groundbreaking films where she's playing the leading lady as a Chinese American and really playing sympathetic parts where she's the heroine who is busting crimes in these films, mm-hmm. Which was a huge change from her early career.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, to kind of get at that, you know, she's gorgeous, she's a fashion icon, but her book also really humanizes and contextualizes all that you just, you know, you said. She was able to capitalize off of and also circumscribed by a culture that sexualized Asian women. She's living in a segregated and racist world. And, you know, she, a lot of her story is similar to all Hollywood women where she's aging and that's not really allowed. So when you were thinking about this and balancing this and not, you know, like just the way you kind of explained it just now, it's like not a victim narrative. There's a lot of amazing things she did. So what were you thinking about as you wrote this to make sure you were honoring her and all her accomplishments, but also really not downplaying what she had to go through to get there?
Right. I mean, you know, having looked at a lot of the way her story is told out in the world, you know, one word always keeps coming up, tragic, right? Mm-hmm. Her life was tragic. And I don't, you know, having spent so much time with Anna May Wong, having read her interviews and her personal letters and things like that, and knowing all of the hoops that she jumped through and the fact that she never quit, right? She never gave up on her career. She was working until, you know, her last breath. She was supposed to be in Flower Drum Song in 1961. So knowing all of that, I could never see her thinking of her own life as tragic, right? Because she had so much agency. She was constantly finding ways to work around the system. And so I really wanted to honor the triumphs, all that she achieved. I mean, of course, there are tragic moments in her life, as there are in many people's lives. And I don't gloss over those, right? We have to deal with them. And in fact, you know, I talk quite a bit about the Good Earth film in my book, even though she's not in that film. But I think it's really important to always understand, like, how does she reframe and respond to these challenges, right? That's really the important aspect. And it shows you who she is, who she truly is.
Yeah. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. And today we are talking about a new book about the wild and shimmering life of Anna May Wong. So you mentioned in there going through like letters and other things. I was curious what, you know, what kind of sources you were able to find and pull through, and if some of these were like kind of never before seen or appreciated for what they were, kind of repositories of her life and the details surrounding it.
Well, one of the wonderful things about doing research in the 2020s is that so much of this material has now been digitized. Newspapers are available online. Movie magazines are also digitized and available online, which makes searching them and finding material that perhaps others might not have been able to find in the past much easier. So I really scoured these databases. I mean, I have thousands of newspaper clippings and things like that. And luckily, you know, even though, you know, Anna May Wong has been dead for more than 60 years, she gave so many interviews and she has such a distinct voice. They really come through in a lot of these pieces. And she also wrote a number of memoir type pieces in her early career, as well as when she traveled to China. And those are very insightful and give us a window into how she experienced things. And in addition to that, there is a number of personal correspondence that she had with several different friends that are held at Yale. And so that was one of the first places I went, was to look at that correspondence. And kind of in the 11th hour of my research, it finally occurred to me, because several of these friends, they all have correspondence at Yale. So it occurred to me to look at the correspondence between her friends to see what they might say about her when, you know, she wasn't in the room, essentially. And that did lead to some very surprising information about, you know, later in her life in the 1950s, she was really struggling as an actor, as well as, you know, with her aging, and she did unfortunately fall into alcoholism. And so there is a very vivid description of one of these episodes where she is supposed to arrive to lunch, but arrives, you know, so inebriated that they have to carry her back to her hotel. So that was actually, I mean, a sad episode, but also very, you know, just something I wouldn't have known had I not found those letters.
Yeah, and reading between the lines, you get to kind of weave together the, you know, some sort of reality between. It seems like to me there's three versions of her. There's the Hollywood version, that's just what people see on screens and stuff. There's, you know, kind of the unvarnished truth. And then there's maybe, you know, in those memoirs and stuff, I'm wondering if she's also trying to reimagine her, what she wants to be. You know, are they like idealized stories of her life, or do they seem pretty, you know, is she still is it still performative, or is it more of an accurate version? And you know, I guess that third person, you know, the friends is kind of a way to kind of weigh in and see what's real and what's being cultivated for, you know, image.
There's probably always an aspect of her interviews and anything public facing that's performative. Although I do think that she tended to be a very straightforward and honest person. I mean, even a lot of interviewers would comment on the fact that she didn't seem like a typical movie star. She seemed like a college girl or the girl next door. She was very relatable. And she also didn't make up a phony backstory like a lot of early Hollywood stars. I mean, she was very honest about the fact that she was Chinese American and she was working in her dad's laundry at the time that she was getting her first Hollywood parts, right? And so that was not, for her, it was not anything to be ashamed of. So of course, her early memoir, she's talking about the origins of her Chinese American family. And she talks very frankly too, you know, many people ask me why am I fluent in English? Well, why shouldn't I be? I'm an American. And in fact, when people hear me speak Chinese, they say I have an American accent. So she always found a way to bring in humor to relate some of the realities of her existence. But of course, when you look at personal correspondence, she's much more frank with her friends, right? Like she would write to Carl Van Vechten in one of her famous letters and say, you know, I was trying out for this part at MGM, but I guess I look too Chinese to play a Chinese because I hear the part's going to Colleen Moore, things like that. So that's something she would never say in public, right? But she would say it to her friends.
And you mentioned too that seeing a photo of her when you were younger was so impactful to you that you kind of morphed it into something else entirely in your psyche, what it looked like. But I was wondering if, in addition to your personal experience, if you were told other stories when you were writing this book of the moments and the epiphanies and the courage or inspiration that she gave to others and how that must have really helped inform and fuel the way you wrote this. And, you know, writing a book is hard. So, you know, it's good to have inspiration along the way, to a drive to do it.
It's an incredible reminder that so many people are still really touched and moved by her work, by seeing her on the screen, you know, I mean, 100 years after her first films came out. And I meet people all the time. I've met several people whose parents named them after her, right? Because they were so proud of what Anna Mae Wong did. They wanted their children, their daughters, to carry on her name. So there is something just magical in the way that she performed on screen. And it really means a lot to, especially to Chinese Americans, to see parts of their own experiences and lives reflected on screen. And I mean, I think that's part of the magic of seeing a photograph of her for the first time, which is, I think, how many people discover her. And in my case, right, it was actually a very mundane photograph compared to all of the ones that, all the glamorous Hollywood photo shoots she's done. But even then, it was enough for me to see her. I mean, I think part of it too is that a lot of Asian Americans, we rarely get to see, you know, our community in historical eras, right? It's as if we didn't exist then. And so when we see those photographs, it's really validating on this, you know, very deep level. And that's something that she does with her work.
And I think too, the, even if it's, you know, a quote unquote mundane photo, that in itself is even more memorable because it's not like a super exotified or fetishized image of her. It's just like her being a person out in the world and, you know, just those, that kind of like presence in the record is so important to see. So just, I want to leave our audience with, if you hope that people take one thing from your book or from exhibits or all the different ways that they can now engage with and get to know Anna Mae right now, what is the one thing that you hope people, you know, take from her story?
I hope that they see how much triumph there is in her story, that she was a true trailblazer. I mean, really, truly, she worked for 4 decades in every single medium, right? Silence, talkies, radio, theater, and then later TV, becoming the first Asian American to lead a television show. And so there's just so much that she accomplished in such a short amount of time. And I mean, the other part is that she's just a really fun person. So reading about her life and all of the things that she did is a really fun ride. And I kind of, you know, when I titled the subtitle Wild and Shimmering, I really mean it. That's what it feels like to be a fly on the wall and follow along through her journey.
And it really comes across in your book, which you listeners can pick up at your favorite local independent bookstore. Thank you so much, Katie, for joining us on this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more at jeffexchange.org or wherever you get your podcasts.